And they built this special fence for 96 individual meters, so that you can't see there, and closed the highway for 8 hours through that part of the desert, and everybody had gotten out of all of them by. This is where all this happened. This is a skyline photograph of the Angeles area, north and upper left corner. This is the bottom of the end of the Sierra Mountains, which trail off into the Tehachapi Mountains over there. This is the San Andreas Fault, that line which runs along there. This is the Darlock Fault. Those two between them define the boundary of the Mojave Desert, which is a downdrop area to the east of them. And there are the dry lake beds in the Mojave Desert. That one is Rogers Flyway. And I guess you can't make out the runways on this picture. These are the transverse ranges, which extend off into the ocean of the Channel Islands. And this is the Los Angeles area, the gray area. There is Pasadena, and right there is Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where they fly the Vikings and the Voyagers. Here is another skyline photograph in great detail of the same area, San Andreas Fault, Darlock Fault, Rogers Fly Lake, and you can just barely make out the runway. I guess the people who are closer here can. And you can see the Mojave is quite fertile, and there is a good deal of civilization there in places where they can irrigate it. And you can see one of the major irrigation projects, in fact, the California aqueduct running right along there. And, well, I won't go through too much of the geology. Where to go? Palmdale is right there, and the route ahead is trucked with something like this. This is morning on the day of the first shuttle test on the bed of Rogers Dry Lake. Picture that I took with 120 degrees pseudo fisheye lens, so you're seeing it further away around the horizon there. And this gives you some small notion of what it means to have 8,000 reporters, 8,000 members of the general public, and a couple hundred reporters out there as well. And they have, among other things, the greatest traffic jam in the history of the Mojave Desert, I can tell you. There's a picture that I took the night before of the orbiter on the back of the 747. And I took a whole series of pictures like this at night before both of the first two tests. And I put in only two of them that I consider the most spectacular. And the one that I'm the proudest of is this one right here. So it's that, okay. Very soon after though, they backed it out. This is the second test. Both the flights were 8 o'clock in the morning and winds are most stable than over the desert. Taxing slowly, it took forever, it took three quarters of an hour to taxi into the position of the runway. This is a chase plane taking off. Somebody probably said, boy, that's what I want for Christmas. So I have to drive that way in California. I have to fly through the phones with. This is the beginning of the takeoff run on the first approach to landing test. Lying with reporters.
With the orbiter on its back, weighs less
and a fully fueled and loaded commercial 747 taking off from Los Angeles for a flight to London. So it was actually rather nimble as a 747 goes. And the other thing was, because of the flight angle and that everything had an undersurface, the orbit itself exhibited quite a bit of lift to the combination. You know, when you're the massive passenger. This is what it looks like to us. Mostly on the ground, we couldn't see anything. We were watching television the way you did. And they were very kind to set up some monitors for us under a big tent there and try to keep out of the sunlight as much as they could. But there's one unforgettable moment. Donnie, can you focus that a little bit better? One unforgettable moment when it did fly over. Here it is at 120,000 feet. And this is a picture I took through a 200-millimeter telephoto lens. You're seeing it on the side. There's a 747 with its tail sticking up, there's the orbit with its tail sticking up, and a little chase point is there right now. We did not get to see the separation on this first flight. And so for that, I'm going to have to show you chase point pictures. And there it is. It just took off, wow, like that. They were very worried about that takeoff, because notice this tail? 90 feet high. That thing happened in the second order, it ruined the entire day. So, they aimed it up at an angle such that the 747 was aimed downward a little bit, the order was perfectly horizontal, and as a result of that angle, the lift was maximum, and it just got up out of the order of B. It just, the chase point pilot set the television camera in data, and that's some pretty fancy pilot also. And the result was the 747 seemed to drop out of there like a stone. It disappeared from the frame and all in maybe half a second.
Did it
hit the ground? No, that's the way it looked on the television because they were watching it and they were scanning the order. Isn't that a picture? Now, this is our first view of it from the ground, and you will see how. I keep forgetting how close it to a better way. Okay, I can see it fine. Well, that's the point. I watch it, and this, I'm showing these pictures practically as rapidly as I took them.
Astonished when it did happen. Why are other people knew it? Nobody's already telling me.
But I didn't know that something was happening, but all of a sudden, 747 began leaving the contract. And so I just made sure that my standard of the telephone wasn't that point. It was a good telephone anyway, but why not? And there is the moment of separation. This is 747, and there is most of the black bottom of the orbit with the white tail sticking out. You can actually see that from the ground. It's incredible. 5 miles up. And then the orbiter and the 747 both, in addition to moving away from one of the vertical factors they can, each one turns in a different direction as violently as it can. It's called turning magnitude, where you get away from each other as fast as possible. And here's what it looks like from the chase plane. And the orbiter leaving two little contrails of its own, which is pretty. And the next one, it's got to be one of the most incredible photographs I've ever seen in the entire space program. It was taken by a little chase plane pilot. In fact, Jordan Paulson, who evacuated the flying chase plane. And there it is. The turn down maneuver. But it's just so perfect. This is the kind of thing that artists paint for artist concepts. And you look at it and you think, you know, that's really unique, but it's so fake because nobody would ever get a photograph like that. But it really was a photograph. It just happened to get it. Absolutely perfect. Maybe I shouldn't say it happened. Maybe you find it all along. I don't know. But there is the dry lake down there, and there you can see the runway. This is the landing, and then you get into the photograph I took. And you see this one was right in front of us. It went in, brutal first, then there you are, afterwards. And the chase point is right beside us, totally see it there. There's the chase point photograph of the landing on the other side. I'm right about there. This is pretty incredible one too. After it was on the ground, the 747 and the chase point flew over the roof. And some good photographer was standing there and got the picture just the right moment. Okay, that's a good place to end it. And I'm excited about the show. Thank you very much. Those of you who wish to leave or have to leave, of course, you're welcome to do so. Remember, we've got mini grab schedules there in the back, and anyone who has questions, I'll be more than happy to take them. I would like to answer questions from the floor, though, for everybody, rather than having you gather around me. And the reason for that is I found if you do it that way, if you have people gather around me, I end up answering the same question 5 times by different people, you know. So let's give the people 1 or 2 a couple minutes to do so, and then we'll take any questions you have. Down back there? Yeah. Yes, I will repeat the question. Is Donna back there, or is anybody from Time Group who knows whether there are any time limits on this? I'm perfectly happy to stay here as long as people have questions, but I don't know if we have to get out of here.
There ain't no limit, right?
Oh. 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock. Okay, that's recorded for an hour. That's wrong. Okay, sure. Question over there.
Next week,
yes.
Are you going to be providing information about
L5? Sure.
And there's a local chapter.
Is there? Oh, I'll do that. Yes, yes. Okay, not in Detroit, though. At least not that I know of. Yeah. Yes, I'll be most happy to provide that information. In fact, I'll give you the address right now if you want. R5? Sure.
No.
Yes. Yes. The problem is that we meet on Tuesday nights when I have a non-credit golf course that, in fact, is described in the handout, so I never get to a meeting. But I have the money there. No, it's U of M. Oh, my course, you mean? The Tuesday night one is in Ann Arbor at the U of M campus in one of the classroom buildings, PC Oil buildings. On Monday night, in addition, we have one at Lackham, which is on the Wednesday campus, although it belongs to U of M. And anybody's interested in that, we've already started, and you probably missed too much of it now, but there will be another course about the solar system which in fact includes some of the things in this, but also a lot more detail, and, you know, a number of topics. I mean, obviously, it's more weeks in Seymour. Some of you might be interested in that anyway. What you get over would be the two Venus lectures and the Eclipse lecture. And in fact, in the course, you'll have more information than you will in these. So it still would not be all already done. Because those are, well, for Venus, for example, here I have two lectures, and they're supposed to be an hour and a half, and there I will have two lectures, each 2.5 hours. So, you know, they won't.
One further way. Have you read the book, Co-Evolution?
The book put out by Co-Evolution Quarterly. I have not read the book per se because I've read all the original articles as they came out in the magazine. It's very fine. I think there are two other books about space colonization that are even better. I'll talk about them next week. Question here.
In the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, they have what looks like a miniature orbiter.
Do it.
Lifting body.
Okay.
Can you tell me something about that?
Question is, can I tell them something about the lifting body which they have in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, I suppose, in Washington? Unfortunately, I can't because I haven't been there. I want to go there, but I haven't been able to make it yet. I would guess there were a series of test flights of several lifting bodies, and they were all in fact at Edwards, and some of the astronauts who were flying them were not on the same flight they were flying the shuttle on this test flight. So I would guess there's one of those, but I don't know. The dog on the water, they're right there.
They're about 25 feet long, I would say.
That's it. Yeah, well, there were several that were, you know, small ones of that size, one person vehicle, and just to get data on the aerodynamics of it.
One more thing, they also have a Skylab there.
Yes, they have a real Skylab.
A real one?
Yes, that is a real thing. And the reason is that they weren't able to get money to fly.
They couldn't get anybody to fly?
They could not get money to fly it. Ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing, the satellite space station, the Saturn V rocket to launch it, the rocket and the Apollo Command Service modules to send the crews up to it, all existed, already bought and paid for. Satellite, the one that we did fly, is probably the most successful space mission in history. The oil and minerals that discovered alone are estimated to be enough to pay for the entire U.S. space program from the beginning of 1958 through the present. And all you would have had to do, you would have more than doubled the result, because you all get more space time around, you would have had mistakes to avoid the first time. All you would have had to do would be to spend the money to actually launch it and get the data, which would have at most increased the satellite budget by 15%. And they wouldn't do it. Oh, I could tell you horror stories like that by the hour. It's just unbelievable. Well, for example, the fact that you turned off the offsets on the moon, you know, which is still operating, and it looks like they're going to turn off the Viking spacecraft on March 1st of next year. It's still operating, but there simply isn't money. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Didn't you actually mention something about those five metals?
The thermal tiles are not metals, they're ceramics. There are five different ceramics that are used, yes.
Five different types of materials?
Yes, five different types of materials. I have no idea what they are. I'm not a ceramic expert. I wouldn't even know what the names meant if I knew if I heard them.
They are
man-made, yes. They're man-made, you know, starting with some natural material. I mean, you go out and mine sand somewhere. But beyond that, I just can't tell you. If you're interested, write to Lockheed Air and Missiles Corporation, and they make it, and I'm sure they would be just delighted that somebody actually knew about it, you know, and cared enough to write. I'm sure they send you tons of information.
How do you get involved with that?
How do you get involved in the astronaut selection? You wait until the next selection is announced, which I cannot give you a time scale for yet, probably within the next few years, and then you write to NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, and I'm sure that's all the address that you need. You know, write attention astronaut selection or something, and ask for a set of application blanks and information on what the requirements are and all that sort of thing. It's not hard to do. It's hard to get in. It's not hard to apply.
Some of those pictures you used in your
lecture? Question is there any place where you get a copy of some of the pictures that I used in my lecture? And the other copy, well, of course, my own answer is no, but the NASA pictures, and there are NASA pictures that are equivalent to many of the ones that I showed, and certainly the Chase Point pictures and so forth that you can get, there are a number of companies which put them out, and the one that I deal with, and have always been very happy with, is called Space Photos in Houston, Texas, and I will give you its address. The reason that I like them is, in the first place, they're pretty inexpensive, and yet have, I think, very high quality. Do you remember that first skylight picture of the Los Angeles Basin area and the Mojave Desert? That's from Space Photos. And, you know, in other etchers, I use lots of their pictures. It happens not in this one, but that's not their fault. They never take the pictures out of print, and they sell them in groups of only five, so you don't have these problems you do with many of the companies, you know, where you've got about 40 to get the one picture that you want. And they're only $1.25 for a set of, I'm sorry, for a set of four, they sell them a set of four. And they have an illustrated catalog with a little reproduction of every single one of their pictures. So you can see ahead of time exactly which ones you want. Their address is Space Photos. That was easy, you know, where it was. There we go. 2608 Sunset Boulevard. It sounds like it's going to be Hollywood, but it's not in Houston. 2608 Sunset Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77005. And there's phone number 2. Area 713-667-9668. Repeat all that for everybody there the first time. Space Photos, 2608 Sunset Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77005, area 713-667-9668. And they have not only shuttle photos, but photographs from all of the early U.S. manned missions and most of the unmanned missions as well. It's a good
Are there any, and if there are, why haven't been used, alternate sources of funding for NASA?
Are there alternate sources of funding for NASA? I assume you mean other than simple tax money. For NASA, by definition, no, because NASA is defined as part of the government. Furthermore, it is defined by its charter as a research and development organization, which means as soon as something that it spent all the money to develop becomes successful, for example, weather satellites or communication satellites, NASA is required to turn them over to others who then make a profit out of them. And so when weather satellites became operational, NASA turned them over to the Weather Bureau, and now the Weather Bureau that makes the satellites. NASA launches them for the Weather Bureau, but the Weather Bureau pays for those launches. However, one thing that NASA is doing, and is very anxious to do for obvious reasons in the shuttle era, is to get a lot of private business on the shuttle. Something that I just didn't have time to talk about is, well, many of the things the shuttle is going to be able to do from the point of view of space industry. And I know you are into these things and you're familiar with a lot of them. Things like making alloys of metals which cannot be mixed together on the ground because they separate like oil and water, but the way they are separated is by gravity, and one is lighter, the other is heavier. And a lot of such substances could have very valuable properties and you just can't make them on the ground. Or certain ways of purifying vaccines which use forces, some of you know what I'm talking about, things like electrophoresis or chromatography, forces that are very, very weak and that have to be used on the ground only in quantities of the vaccine that are so tiny that you can use capillarity to overcome gravity. We'll do it in space and you can use the same things for ton locks. And it is very likely that routinely the world production of several of the major vaccines will be done in the shuttle by the end of the 1980s, will be done in space. And they'll be cheaper that way, they'll be in some cases pure, and certainly more easily purified. There's a prime example of something that's tailor-made for shuttle-level space industrialization. You're not moving U.S. steel into space with shuttle, you know, too much quantity involved, too much material. But a vaccine is a fine example of something which not all that much is used of. The entire world's supply of polio vaccine in a year could easily fit into one shuttle cargo bay, and which is valuable per cubic centimeter, and which can be made better or cheaper or both in space than on the Earth. So those are examples. Well, there are lots and lots of things that industry can do in space. And NASA is trying very hard to sell cargo space or even entire flights to industry for their own uses. And there's a whole set of elaborate rules. So far, the space program is said to be completely open in the sense that any data that you've got were to be released as soon as possible, you know, on everybody's property. And of course, industries don't like that. They've got trade secrets they've got to protect, that kind of thing. And so for some of these flights, the industry doesn't even have to tell NASA what it's doing. It has to sign assurances that it isn't going to do anything that is detrimental to national security, that could be dangerous, or that would be incompatible with something else that was going on in the same flight. For example, if you're trying to make astronomical observations and there's something in there cooking away which is giving off clouds of vapor you're getting from your telescope, you know, that's an example of incompatibility. The most expensive way to do that is buy yourself an entire shuttle flight, and that'll set you back $25 million. Have been too many takers for that. There's been some interest expressed. Generally, industry has been toning the water very cautiously before getting in. Tell you right now, though, my temperament, my psychology, is not in a business direction. I'm just not a business kind of person. But if I were, I would be absolutely thrilled. There are people right now who are making the decisions that are going to make them billionaires. You know, this is just like being in Henry Ford's basement when he said, "Hey, I got an idea." You know, and anybody in the audience who is a business type, you know, or tycoon type, and willing to pay me a modest commission after you've made your first billion, I'd really appreciate it. You know, for the fact you got the idea here. The place where industry has been jumping out, to the point where they've already got a number of shuttle flights already filled with them. In fact, they've already got, between the scientific uses and the industrial uses and everything else, all the shuttle flights for the middle of 1981 are already committed. This thing out of the Amazon space yet. They want to tell you roughly what every flight is going to be about. And of course, there'll be changes in that, you know, if something goes wrong, you have to change the order of the flight or something like that. But the cheapest way to do it is to buy a getaway special. A getaway special is the capability of flying a package which must be self-contained, must not require any astronaut attention, and of course must be safe and so forth and so on, about the size of a large shoebox. And it can be anything that you want flown up and exposed to space, and it's got to be self-contained, it's got to do it all itself. If you need astronaut attention, you can do a two-week empire. And getaway special is $3,000. Now that's pretty cheap for flying something into space. And there's already been a lot of interest in that, both from industry and from other people. A number of educational institutions have bought that for their students. You know, never before in the history of spaceflight could you give an aerospace engineering student a real, honest-to-gosh space project to work on. Because, you know, you were going to be out $20 million if it failed. But with $3,000 and the capability of dividing that payload into a number of separate compartments and giving each one to a student, it's a very reasonable thing for educational institutions. And not only colleges, but even high schools have bought getaway specials for their students. All right. So that kind of in part answers your question. A full answer will keep us here for the rest of the night. Sure. A copy of that slide? No, because that's my own. However, that's my own slide. There's no place that I know you can buy it. However, I can certainly tell you where to get the data, and you can make your own chart, which probably just as good. The data comes from a publication of the U.S. Department of Commerce, which is a monthly publication called Survey of Current Business. And it can be found in the U.S. Library. I'm sure Detroit Public has it, and I know the U of M Library has it. The U of M Library and all of it has it in the periodicals room on the first floor of the undergraduate library. What you do is, when you found where they keep Survey of Current Business, you look up the July issue of whatever year you might be interested in, and there is a complete statistical breakdown of the entire U.S. economy. Everything we spend on each of the governmental organizations, including NASA, everything that we spend on government social programs, federal, state, local, you know, add them all together,
and hair them, do whatever you want with them. All the data are right there, and the alcohol and tobacco and everything are there too. The only thing that was on that tour that isn't in that tour was the cost of Apollo 17 and the cost of 1 year of Skylab, and those aren't a terribly great interest anymore. I mean, that's why 6 years ago now. Question here.
The cargo bay pressurized?
The cargo bay is not pressurized on the orbiter.
So the orbiter can open in
space? That's right. The doors can simply open space with no pressure.
Is it a big hydraulic kind of
open
door
that you talk about? Well, it's a lot to talk about. I mean, only had an hour and a half, and I ran over 15 minutes as it was. I believe it's a hydraulic system, and I think that I have somewhere in my archives all kinds of detailed information on exactly how it works, and I just want to know what the number. I'll tell you, my knowledge of these things tends to be more about the scientific applications than about the engineering gadgetry. And so the level we're talking about here tonight about the gadgetry is, very close to the level that I know. I could have talked for probably about 3 times as long, but I say everything I know.
We had a program on the other night about the mechanics of
it. Did they? Okay.
Doors,
oh, Channel 9, yeah.
The bay doors, the arms, and all that won't even operate on Earth.
They will not operate on Earth.
They said that.
That's even tested on Earth.
Well, perhaps they have an assist of some sort.
They must have touched it somehow, yeah.
Because they said these things are built to be light and emissions.
I see. They're built to operate in zero G environment, yeah. Well, something that I do know is that they've got to have. Say it.
It won't support its own weight on Earth.
Will not support its own weight.
Huh.
The manipulator arm.
Yeah, they had all sorts of assists on that.
Huh, fascinating. Okay. There are times, they're very rare and few and far between, but there are times when I wish I had a television. but they're so rare and few and far between that I haven't gone out and bought one yet. Excuse me. The one thing that I do know is that there is a system to bleed the air on the cargo bay gradually and non-catastrophically as you go up into space. But the cargo bay is non-pressurized. Which is why, for example, in space lab, you must have a pressurized separate module for people to work in a mature-free environment in case of when that's necessary. You can have a space lab that's all pallets. Then what you have is a little drum that's just big enough to hold a man or a woman. We've got a whole new terminology here. What do you say? You can't call it manned spaceflight anymore. What do you say? If people start using words like person spaceflight, I'm going to... pilot. Yeah. Why not? Pilot and pilot. Okay, anyway, just big enough for one human being to fit into, they call it the igloo. And, that's where you go out and look at it and see what has to be kicked or whatever.
NASA
did develop a computer system. Well, IBM built it, under contract to NASA. It's clearly a system, that's something else that we can talk about. Obviously, that computer, since it's flying, is going to have to be pretty good. And so what they have is not just one computer. There are four separate, independent computers, each, any one of which is capable of doing all the problems all by itself. And in practice, the way they run them is all four solve every problem, and then they compare answers. And if one of them gets a different answer from the other three, the other three say, you're sick, and they vote out of the system. And then, of course, tell the pilot that this happened so they can do something about it. On top of all that, there is a completely separate fifth computer, unconnected to all the other four, which is capable of getting the moment in emergency if they have to. So it's far beyond the ball and suspenders school of redundancy. Several third of the leash. What about that? Everybody agrees it's going to be one that's high enough up that it will be equipped no more than 1 or 2% of the time, and then these low level will shut up again. So a space colony would have its own safety arrangements, and it would be quite separate. But to answer your specific question, which was, is there any way that you could pressurize the cargo bay for whatever reason, for some sort of rescue or anything else? No. I take it back. No, under present plans. Of course, if somebody builds a big pressurized pod to go into it, yes, sure. You know, they do. I mean, the shuttle will probably carry anything you put in as long as it's not too heavy and doesn't have a ridiculous center of gravity, that kind of thing. Nobody's doing it. There doesn't even be a reason to. At least if so, I haven't heard about it. Okay, then a caller? The answer is no, I think.
Yeah, I heard that the fire department and American Red Cross actually came to a burn treatment center for the continuous lab, mm-hmm. space platform. Could you elaborate on that at all?
The question is, have I heard anything about reports that NASA is going to have a burn treatment center in space? You would need a full-scale space station for that. The shuttle, of course, would not be sufficient because the shuttle can't stay up there. And it is something that has been discussed. It's an obviously good environment for a burn patient because no portion of your body needs to be in contact with the bedclothes or whatever. And people who are severely burned over large parts of their body, you know, that's one of the big problems in treating them. There's got to be some side that they're lying on. On the other hand, you have a problem getting them up there in the first place. You know, the shuttle will have a gentle acceleration profile. Nothing, at no point in either the flight into space or the flight back, will there be an acceleration or a deceleration greater than 3 gravity. Compare that with a maximum of over 8 for Apollo. And there are a lot of reasons for that. That, in fact, is a major reason that the shuttle is as big, almost as big, and powerful as the Saturn V, even though it's only going into low Earth orbit. It has more fuel. If you do deliberately waste some fuel in order to have that low acceleration profile, plus you save money hand over fist because that way you don't have to have as fancy satellites. You don't have to have satellites with this murderous combination we need now of very high reliability, very great miniaturization, and extreme ruggedness just to withstand a few moments of vibration at launch. And the shuttle cargo bay is so big you can waste up the space with padding and that kind of stuff too. So probably all that much of a problem to get them up there. But there would be a matter of, there would be all kinds of problems, you know. Who goes? I mean, how do you choose the few patients that you'd be able to treat? So far, to the best of my knowledge, it's in a speculation stage because a true space station, a large space station for any purpose, has not been officially funded. Question was that there?
Well, when you put the space
colony,
the
Indian
program, they had sort of red blood cell increase.
Yes, they did.
They mm-hmm. had something like a giant space colony, 10,000 people, and they stayed up.
In the first place, the space colonies, well, first I'll talk about them next week. They will have artificial gravity, full 1G, so you don't have that problem. But you will have a new situation which you've never had before, and that is some workers in the space colonies moving daily from where they live in the space colony, in their house, which is a 1G environment, into a 0G environment where they're doing 0G processing in space, and then back again. We've never had that before. We've had astronauts who were at 1G for all their life, went up into space and spent a long time in 0G, and then at the end, one came back into 1G. So we just don't know if there's any problem with continuous back and forth changes. Probably the answer is no, but that's an example of the kind of research that has to be done before we commit ourselves to a space problem. You know, it's not absolutely certain yet that we can do it. It seems very likely, but it would be premature at this point to say, okay, here's the money, go build it. You know, first you need some additional research, and that's an example of the kind of thing it has to be looked at. However, aside from that, Skylab had as one of the 3 major functions biomedical tests to find out whether exposure over a long duration to space conditions, including radiation, was safe for the human body.
because you were concerned about the one that you mentioned, that is that in earlier spaceflight, the astronaut's red blood cell had counted gone down. There was also concern about weight loss, about the arrangements in the body's potassium balance, and a few other problems like that. And after all, there was no reason in the world to assume we were suited for 1G, because we and all of our ancestors had evolved for how many billion years there has been life on Earth, at least 3 billion, in a 1G environment. And incredibly enough, and I think this sounds, all of this Skylab does, when we look back on it from a couple of centuries later, people will say, this is the most important. Every single one of those changes levels off and stops increasing at a plateau level, which is safe, somewhere between the third and the fifth week of weightlessness. No earlier spaceflight had been quite that long, and so they'd all be seen falling, and they could never be sure that at some point they were to plateau. They not only do plateau, but in all cases the plateau is to the same level. If you exercise a great deal while you're awake. And the final Skylab flight in which they were waiting for 3 months, 84 days, a record which is probably about to be broken, by the way, next month, early in March, by the current 76 crew. They had been waiting for 3 months, and they exercised an hour and a half a day, and it was tedious as all get out, but that's all it was, and that's all you need, apparently. Now, of course, there's always a possibility that if you live in zero G for a year instead of 3 months, you got a problem, but it seems very unlikely. The chances are if you can stand it for 3 months, you can stand it forever. Space colony inhabitants would not stand it forever, but there would be some that would be working in zero G part of their working day, and that's a new situation. That's one of the good reasons for building a space station. We're going to have to build at least one space station on the way to building a space colony for just this kind of research. Okay, I think you were next.
What happened to Skylab?
It is a dead orbiting body. It is in a particular stable configuration so that the Earth's two largest moons, the Moon and Skylab, are both always facing one side towards the Earth. And the last crew left its arrows. They let the air out. And it would not be safe to try to put the air back in, because ever since it was abandoned in February of 72, the attitude, the orientation in space of the station has not been the one that was designed for, namely one particular side facing towards the sun. And so the thermal balance is all shot, and the thermal expansion and contraction is undoubtedly weakened the metal to the point where you try to pressurize it again, and it just goes spawning in 15 different places. But what they did do in the last crew was collect a number of samples of various materials and devices which the engineers wanted to have exposed to space conditions for a long time, and leave them conveniently tied together in a bundle right inside the airlock door, so that someday, if somebody was able to revisit Skylab, they'd be able to collect this and bring it home and the engineers could study it, much as the Apollo 12 astronauts did with pieces of Surveyor 3, and the Apollo 17 astronauts collect a number of samples on the moon, and someday somebody will go back to the Apollo 17 site and get them. The first shuttle test flight, if all goes well, is scheduled to go off Skylab, rendezvous with it, and fasten onto it a small rocket motor, which will do one of two things, and so far there's still a lot of work which to do. Number one is to put it up into a higher orbit. Number two is to deliver it into the Earth's atmosphere at a known location, so it will either burn up completely, or if it doesn't, it'll go in at a controlled place and nobody will get hurt as a result of any pieces of land. And I like to put it into a higher orbit because I'd like to see it saved. If this were not done, Skylab would re-enter the atmosphere at a totally unpredictable location. Well, three-quarters of the Earth's surface is covered by water and one-tenth of the land is uninhabited, so your chances are pretty good. But, of course, we just saw what could happen when a satellite, which is dangerous, I mean, that was just so stupid, putting a nuclear reactor in a satellite without well in orbit. But, you know, we've seen what could have happened, and fortunately, it came down pretty.
could have happened, and fortunately, it came down in Great Salt Lake instead of downtown Detroit. You know, next time it's going to be downtown Detroit, it's not likely, but it could happen. And Skylab will re-enter sometime around 1981 or 1982. That's uncertain because it depends. The Earth's upper atmosphere's density increases and decreases enormously. The atmosphere breathes in and out according to solar activity. And we're coming up on a solar activity maximum. And part of the question is how high that maximum will be. If it's a really major maximum, then the air will be denser at Skylab height than it would be otherwise. Skylab will re-enter faster than the thought. We'll see about that one. So, long answer to a short question, but that's the answer.
First of all, I wondered if you heard that the Russians, they believe now, just today or yesterday, put up another one.
Oh, really? No, I didn't hear that.
And they're afraid that it does have a reactor, because they're being very quiet about it.
Oh, well, the Russians launch satellites all the time. One of the lesser known facts about the Russian space program is they're now launching 5 times as many satellites as we are and spending 4 times as much money as we are.
Well, this is supposedly one of the same series. Why about it?
Well, what do you mean by the same series, though? If it was just called Cosmos, probably every Russian satellite
right.
called Cosmos. You know, one of the most impressive things about that whole story was something almost nobody noticed. But one thing the news media kept insisting on, one of the numerous things they do that annoy me, I'm not getting the name of it, so that you can recognize it, it said a Russian satellite. Its name was Cosmos 954. And that really means it was the 954th satellite in the Cosmos series. We made Cosmos 1000 this year.
Well, this is 1987.
1987 was launched? Okay, that's yeah. So, you know, it was just another Cosmos. That doesn't prove anything, because they use the name Cosmos for almost everything they put up.
Well, what they said in the news was the press release was identical to the press release of 954.
They always are. The press releases are always identical.
I don't know what
the Cosmos name is used by the Russians for any space mission whose purpose they don't want to talk about, and that is most Russian space missions. And all of the press releases are identical. Cosmos 1 was accompanied by a press release which said this is the beginning of a new series of satellites for scientific research, period. They aren't scientific research, most of them are military. Some of them are. I mean, they put up weather satellites in the series and so on. And they all, you know, they look different. They're really 8 different series. There are some such number. And then all of the subsequent press releases say, we have launched another satellite. The Cosmos series was launched such and such a time. Its number was such and such. See press release dated such and such about Cosmos 1 for further details. So, of course, the press release was the same.
Okay, I didn't know either way. And then my question was, there's a tech book that's put out, a tech publication, financed, I don't know whether it's monthly or what. And like you said, they have to release anything that they develop and as quickly as possible.
Yes.
And I wondered if you knew how I could get a hold of this. I've seen it, and I knew of other people who have been getting it, but they just said they just happened to start getting it.
I see.
And you get on these mailing lists,
yes.
But it's an eternal thing.
That's right.
And,
I spent much of my time finding out how to get on specific NASA mailing lists. I do not know the answer. I don't even know how to start to find out the answer, except find yourself a friendly aerospace engineering professor that's already on the mailing list. The chances are, a lot of it is a matter of knowing whom to write to and what to say. In fact, I take back that thing about write. My experience for many years of dealing with NASA is that you get much more out of them when you phone than when you write. That's your problem. But, again, you may be able to find out better by phoning. You know, first check with anybody you can think of that might know, and you've already done that with me, and I plug for you, because I'm not interested in that specific area, and so I never bother to find out how you got on that mailing list. And, you know, check some other people who might know, and when they've given you an informed yes, then phone that person, and if that person isn't it, the chances are that person will tell you who the right person is. Maybe not. Another thing that I found, the field centers are usually more approachable than NASA headquarters in Washington. So I would try Johnson Space Center in Houston first. And, of course, Houston Information can give you, you know, the main number, and that's the best I can do for you. If you were a newsman, I could tell you who I would contact, but you're not, and he'd get mad at you if you contacted him and you're not, unfortunately. The news media have unbelievable privileges, which, of course, most of them throw away. NASA's PR is utterly inept, just mostly. I mean, They're really great in that they'll just give you tons and tons of information, all of which is so technical that maybe one newsman in 100 can understand it. I happen to be one of the 100 because I specialize in such.
Well, we have a good friend who's a reporter for a newspaper, so. And we have another fellow who's in L5, we'll be giving a talk at our club up in Midland this next week on space colonization. And I saw some of the stuff you...
because you can't read, but in my more rational moments, I suspect what happens is you go there and everybody does look like a quote bonafide news medium, which in NASA terminology does not mean it's talking about a planetarium, for example. No matter how large it may be, and no matter how many people interested in space come through and actually read the display that they were put up. But it does include the simple Arkansas private chicken farm. Well, we'll take a hypothetical example. I'll give you an example that's not hypothetical. At JPL, which usually is head and shoulders above the rest of NASA and PR, the night of the first Viking landing, a bunch of science fiction writers showed up. And they just wanted to get into, you know, general atmosphere. One of them is Robert Heinlein. Well, half the people on Viking probably there because they read Heinlein's Mars story as a kid. The reason I was there, I'm one of the reasons, you know. And Larry Niven was one of them, Theodore Sturgeon, Jerry Cornell, a bunch of others. And these idiot press officers would not let them in because they were not news media. But there was a guy, I was in it. And so I know who was there. The guy was walking around with his badge. Your badge is your name and your affiliation. The affiliation was Pomona Shoppers News. So I suggest you search yourself a little publication about the Central Arkansas Tri-Week Chicken Farmer. Yeah, it might work.
You mentioned the pocket calculator. What other everyday kind of spin-offs that we have that we're not aware of?
Yeah, LED watches. NASA has books on that, which they'll, that's one of the few things that you can generate prior free up without very much trouble. And I just don't have the list memorized very well because most of them are pretty unspectacular. And, you know, you mention any single one and people say, well, you know, so well, we could live without that. And the one thing we could live without, you know, it's the combination of a whole set of them. The one everybody always mentions is the Teflon, and that is not an example of space thing. It was developed in the 1930s. I'm just trying to think of some of the ones that I've seen NASA brag about specifically in press releases. An improved heart pacemaker that they're very proud of. I don't know how you put that in dollars and cents terms, but, you know, save some lives. And reduce the necessity of surgery. Used to be, you had a pacemaker, every 5 years you had to have heart surgery, you had to have battery change. And now that's been greatly reduced. You know, it's embarrassing because I ought to have a list. That question comes up fairly often. But the reason I don't is that, you know, most of them do kind of go into spectacular. I'm sorry, check the library. For the last several years, they put out a book called Spinoff 7010, Spinoff 76, Spinoff whatever the year was. Some libraries may have those, and if not, my guess is, we just wrote NASA Washington, D.C., please send me either your book, spin off so-and-so, and send it to do it, or tell me how to buy it, you know, and you can buy it from government brain on for any kind of teacher or something.
Why do the chase planes
stay
so close on the landing? Do they actually go out and land next to
the... The chase planes don't stay quite as close as those pictures that I took may give me the impression, because they were taken with teleporter lens, and it has a tendency to squeeze things together in distance and make them more closer than they really are. They were, however, very close, and I don't know the reason for that fully. Part of it, we're going to take better pictures, and part of it is you've got to consider the aerodynamic characteristics of the whole ensemble. You know, the big thing is going to set up turbulence, which could mess up the smaller things around you. And many of our light plane has crashed because he happened to get half a mile behind some jet that was landing at the same airport, and literally know there was clear air turbulence extending all that far back. So I'm sure that somebody somewhere has done a study just where those chase planes could be. And it was surprising, it was fairly close to the big beast, but I'm guessing on that one. You people are doing a better than usual job of finding things that I don't know the answer to, which is good.
You mentioned
the
creation of
an
1G
gravity in
space lab.
Yeah, a space colony, not space lab. No, space lab would be 0G.
How is it?
Rotation. I hate to say centrifugal force because it is in the centrifugal number of force, but you know what I mean. Now, the problem with that is that the human balance apparatus in the inner ear does not like being in a rotating environment that spins at more than one RPM. Okay, put those two numbers together, one RPM and one G, and find out the diameter that it's got to be in order to give you one G at one RPM. And it turns out the thing is embarrassingly big, just over 1 mile in diameter. And that is why the first colony, which is still relatively small, housing maybe 10,000 people, put you out several million people, you know, they will be big, it'll be tens of miles in size. But the first one, you want them to be as small as possible. And that's why the first one is probably going to be a toroid, a donut shape, in which most of that 1 mile diameter isn't occupied by colony. Right here? Yeah, the question is, what purpose does the chase plane serve as in taking photographs? That's what their purpose is, taking photographs and making other observations. You have no idea how many data they take on these tests, especially after the first one. The first one they were a little bit easy on. But that entire 747, they ripped out all the seats, and that entire plane is crammed to the gills with recording apparatus. And, of course, without computers, there's no way they can handle all that. But the amount of information they take on their things is just bad. So I don't know specifically what the chase planes are doing other than taking pictures, but I'm sure they're making other observations as well. Those pictures are valuable. The purpose of them is not just so I can give lectures and say, gee, isn't that a pretty picture. For example, you take a whole sequence of pictures of the separation one after another, and of course you're taking movies as well still. In fact, next time I'm going to give you a movie to start off with a short movie with the approaching handicap. I don't happen to have it this week, which would be the obvious time to have it, so we're going to put it on next week. And, engineers look at that and they say, okay, how rapidly did it separate? Did it separate as rapidly as it should have? That gives you a notion of what its less to drag ratio is, which is a pretty important thing to know. What was the aerodynamics like when you took the tail cone off? How much vibration did it cause in the back of 747? I'll give you, instead of a number answer that only a computer would love, a human answer from 50 years old and moved to the 747, the 747 crew commander. He said that it was less than expected. There was noticeable buffeting, and if there had been passengers back there, passengers probably would have complained, but he, as a test pilot, wouldn't bother. So, you know, it was in that level. Annoying, but not disastrous. I'm told we have to get out at 10 o'clock, and it's now 1 minute of 10, so let's see if I can take a 1 minute question here, and, okay? Oh, I'm sorry, okay, well, let's take a look at that. The shuttle has to land on water? You lose yourself a shuttle. If you're lucky, you may not lose yourself to the astronaut. It can't do everything. One of the things that it ain't is a boat. And
when the Russian satellite went down, they said there were some 5,000 man-made satellites.
That's right. Now that counts all the dead satellites, as well as the live ones, all the dead rocket cones, rocket stages and those cones and so on. On the average, about 5,000 have already been burned up too. So about 10,000 objects have been put into orbit in 20 years of the space age. On the average, a new one goes up every day, which is to say, on the average, there's a launch every 3 days, most of the Russian, and it puts an average of 3 objects into orbit. And on the average, an old one re-ends and burns up every day. So the number is almost a steady state. And it has taken something like 10 years to grow from 4,000 to 5,000, and in the first 10 years, it grew all the way up to 4,000. Now it is almost a steady state. Now that sounds like an incredible assemblage of space junk, and you think, good heavens, you know, it'd be like going through a machine gun fire to fly up there. There's a project calculator now that's going to be giving that to us, and figure out how much space each one of those has all to itself. Assuming that they're all within a layer 100 miles thick, which they aren't, and they're more spread out than that, and then simply multiply 100 miles by the surface area of the Earth, which is 200 million square miles, and you will get the number of cubic miles. Divide that by 5,000, and you'll find that each one has several million cubic miles to itself. There has, in fact, been only one case in all of space history of a collision between two satellites which wasn't intentional. I mean, obviously you don't count a Rhonda Gould document that was meant to happen. Even that one is hardly a fair account because the two satellites launched in the same orbit by the same rocket. And about a year later, they came together, gently touched antennae, not to each other any damage, separated, bounced off, and far as I know, still happy today. I hope you're still happy, and I'll see you next week.